Every day, radio, the nightly news, movies, and TV shows bring us images of violence. They also show us how violence is dealt with. It generally involves the police, some form of punishment, and usually more violence. We are told we live in a world where it is common, accepted, and even expected that violence is needed to end violence. But what if this weren't the case? What if you had other options? The Storytelling and Organizing Project, an Oakland-based program with partners all over the country and the world, is collecting and sharing stories about everyday people taking action to end interpersonal violence in ways that don't rely on policing or traditional social service models that focus heavily on detention, deportation, imprisonment, and violence. I sat down with Rachel Herzing and Isaac Ontiveros to learn how this program is changing the way people think about situations of harm in their daily lives.
And the idea was to get really good minds in the room and figure out how to develop some tools and materials and build out a network of people so that there would be increased ability, increased resources, and increased confidence to intervene in situations of interpersonal harm when they happen, so that people wouldn't feel as if they were left with the option of only calling the cops, but felt like they might be able to take matters into the hands of their own communities, their own family networks, their own social networks. These stories are a really good vehicle to help people engage or learn about new things or figure out kind of what they could apply to their own situations. Because the idea really is that communities are already, engaged in all different kinds of strategies to, prevent, intervene in, and repair from harm. And don't necessarily need to rely on the cops to come in or a shelter to tell them what to do or the court to mandate something.
We're trying to get these stories so that people can draw like actively and in a community-based setting, in a collective setting, that they can draw out lessons from these stories, that they can transform those lessons into tools that they would use to push their work forward. So that our idea is that the storytelling, the story collecting element is in service of making political change, right? So making shifts in power, building up our capacity for our communities to be self-determined. So there's all these different ways that we relate to storytelling as far as a tool of community organizing.
Stories are powerful. They are how we make sense of what's going on around us. What's rational, what's real, what's even possible. When we're inundated with one very loud story day in and day out, that story becomes the truth. The only truth. It's hard to imagine alternatives. The Storytelling and Organizing Project is amplifying our very real, very powerful stories around different ways to address violence. And by doing so, they are equipping us with the tools to envision and create communities and lives of our own choosing.
He korero iti, a small story. We live in a town, but many of my husband's whānau, or extended family, live in the valley where he grew up about 40 kilometres away. My husband and his brother are renowned for a number of things, one being how they extend the life of their cars and vans using highly technical items like string and wire. Another, how they share these vehicles for a variety of tasks, such as moving furniture or transporting relatives, building materials, tractor parts, rongoa or traditional herbal medicines, eels, vegetables, dogs and pigs, dead or alive. They are renowned for being people of the people, the ones to call on in times of trouble and death, the ones who will solve the problem and make the plan. They travel to and from town to the coast to dive for seafood, to endless meetings, to visit whānau along the many kilometres of dirt roads in and around the valley, through flood or dust, depending on the season, in those patched up, beat up, prized cars. There are a number of things to know about the valley, One is that the last 33 children in the world of their hapū ririki to grow up and be educated on their own lands go to school here despite government efforts to close the school. Another is that the valley is known to outsiders and insiders as patuwahine, literally meaning to beat women, and this is not said as a joke. The mountain for this valley is named as the doorway spirits pass through on their way to their final departure from this life. The valley is also the valley where my husband and his siblings were beaten at school for speaking their first language. It is the valley their mother sent them to so they would be safe from their father, back to her people. It is where they milked cows, pulled a plough, fed pigs but often went hungry, and were stock-whipped, beaten, and worse. My brother-in-law still lives in the valley and a group of houses next to the school, so it's no surprise that one of our cars would be parked by these houses, right by where the children play. Perhaps also not a surprise that while playing that time-old international game of rock throwing, our 8-year-old nephew shattered the back window of the car. If I'd been listening, I probably would have heard the oh and ah of the other children that accompanied the sound of glass breaking from town. And if I'd been really tuned in, I would have heard the rapid, frightened heartbeat of that boy as well. His mother is my husband's cousin, and she was on the phone to us right away. She was anxious to assure us that that boy would get it when his father came home. His father is a big man with a pig hunter's hands who hoists his pigs onto a meat hook unaided. He is a man of movement and action, not a man for talking. Those hands would carry all the force of proving that he was a man who knew how to keep his children in their place. Beating that boy would be his way of telling us that he had also learned his own childhood lessons well. So before he got home, we burned up the phone lines. Sister to sister, cousin to cousin, brother-in-law to sister-in-law, wife to husband, brother to brother. This was because my husband and his brother know that there are some lessons you are taught as a child that should not be passed on. The sound of calloused hand on tender flesh, the whimpers of watching sisters, the smell of your own fear, the taste of your own blood and sweat as you lie in the dust, useless, useless, better not born. This is a curriculum like no other. A set of lessons destined to repeat unless you are granted the grace of insight and choose to embrace new learning. So when the father of that boy came home and heard the story of the window, that boy was protected by our combined aroha, or love, and good humour, by the presence of a senior uncle, by invitations to decide how to get the window fixed in the shortest time for the least money. Once again, phone calls were exchanged with an agreement being made on appropriate restitution. How a barrel of diesel turns into a car window is a story for another time. Next time my husband drove into the valley, it was to pick up the car, and that boy was an anxious witness to his arrival. My husband also has very big hands, hands that belong to a man who has spent most of his life outdoors. These were the hands that reached out to that boy to hug, not hurt. A lot of bad things still happen in the valley, but more and more they are being named and resisted. Many adults who learned their early lessons there will never return. For tangata whenua, or the people of the land, this is profound loss. Our first identifiers on meeting are not our own names, but those of our mountains, rivers, hapū or sub-tribes, and iwi, tribes. To be totally separate from these is a dislocation of spirit for the already wounded. This is only a small story that took place in an unknown valley, not marked on many maps. When these small stories are told and repeated, so our lives join and connect. When we choose to embrace new learning and use our bigness to heal, not hurt, then we are growing grace and wisdom on the earth. Dai Grinnell, Whangarei, Aotearoa, New Zealand.
What helps us build toward our own liberation, our own self-determination, is the idea that we can challenge the dominant narrative with the narratives of our daily lives. And every single one of these stories that says something different lays down a stronger and stronger and stronger foundation for somebody who might really be buying kind of this dominant narrative to believe that they have additional options. And I think within that, also seeing themselves as part of a broader set of people who are making different choices, so that it's less isolated, not just in terms of being a survivor of violence or being an intervener in a situation of interpersonal harm, but also seeing yourself as part of a movement of people who are interested in taking different kinds of steps.
A friend of mine in Melbourne, who is a black woman, was walking along a crowded city street and got attacked by 7 white men who verbally and racially abused her and threatened violence. She managed to leave that situation, but it was completely anonymous. She doesn't know who the people were. During the attack, people were crossing the street to not engage with what was happening. And she told us about it, and then we decided to talk to her about responding as a community. The idea was to respond personally as friends, but also to respond politically, as in, that's what happened in our neighbourhood kind of thing. And so about 15 people met up and talked about what had happened and decided to respond by going into that neighbourhood. We found out that there was a white supremacy gig happening in the pub on that street that night, and one of the women in the group was a printer, so we made these stickers that said, "Racism is not welcome here," and went round and made this pamphlet that said, "Speak out against racism." There's these stickers that get put up in Australia that say, "Refugees are welcome here," and so it was kind of modelling off that, saying, but we wanted it to be something where not just putting up the sticker in like a tokenistic way, but actually trying to get people in that town to kind of engage with what was going on. And lots of people wouldn't put up the sticker, but you know, maybe a third of the people did. And we did some radio, some media about it. Not specifics about what had happened to her, but that there was an attack the same night that there was this white supremacy gig. And so we went and spoke to like 300 shop owners along those two streets and said, a woman from this neighbourhood was attacked and people didn't respond. They just kind of ignored it and definitely walked away from her. And so we want you to put up this sticker, and by putting it up, we want you to take responsibility for speaking out against racism in this space and in this neighbourhood. And so we had lots of things about what that means to be taking responsibility and speaking out, not just putting up a sticker. We spoke to about 300 shops, and about maybe 100 of them put up this sticker and agreed to do it. The stickers are still up on the street with like maybe a year on, which is, I don't know, they're kind of around. So I guess it's a little bit out there. And I think it was really important for this person to respond to her, not to just say, "Oh, that really sucks, honey, let me give you a hug," and you know, to not actually care or whatever. Nothing really happened without her saying, "Yes, I do want that to happen." Like when we came out with the idea, she was like, "Yes, do that." And when we wrote the thing of speak out against racism, she was like, "Yes, I support you doing that." And when we did media, "Yes, I support you doing that." I don't really think we had an endpoint in mind, which means that we didn't plan for it to be an ongoing thing, which really, if you're trying to talk about shaping how a community is going to respond to racist violence, which is obviously not a one incident thing, it's an ongoing culture and structure, trying to figure out ways to make it a sustainable thing rather than just a once off. I think it's really good that we responded, and that's better than nothing. But I also think it signified that there's a lot of work that needs to be done, and that could have been something that kept happening.
Every time we hear a story like that, we're reminded of our own power to choose how we deal with situations of harm in our daily lives. But it can still be challenging to take that first step.
Thing one is to ask for support, to build out some support around yourself so that you don't end up being isolated in it. For people who want to intervene, I think, you know, to be both measured and willing to take some risks. And, you know, not to wait necessarily because you're afraid you're not going to get it right, or you don't have the right training, or, you know, somebody told you you got to call the cops, you know. I think, again, you probably don't want to do it alone, to try to figure out how to get a collective, you know, even a small number of people engaged who can help figure out how to navigate the situation, reduce as much harm as possible within that situation, and then figure out kind of what can shift things longer term.
The ways to intervene, the ways to address, the ways to repair, and all these things can be very simple. And I don't mean simple as in insignificant. I mean drawing on what's in front of us and drawing on the strength that exists between us in our families or in our neighborhoods or at our workplaces and so on.
I've been told my whole life by the media, movies, and people in positions of authority that I don't have much power, and that they are in positions of power for good reason. mostly because I need them to be there, and that this is just the natural order of things. Hearing the stories collected by Stop reminds me that people used to think that the world was flat and the universe revolved around it. Today, that sounds crazy, but not too long ago, it was irrefutable fact. Who knows? Maybe our notions of violence and policing will one day be thought of as equally nonsensical. Opening up to the possibilities of new ideas expands our ability to make real choices about how the world around us works. And that is real power.
I feel like the things I've learned are like uncountable, but they all kind of have this ripple that I can't describe any other way. It's just like a profound level of hopefulness, especially given what we're taught about how violent the world is that we live in and how hopeless things are and how we don't have options. And learning ways to break out of the isolation gives us all kind of strength and hope that actually builds us up, not only to like heal, right, but to fortify ourselves in different ways that can have all these really significant impacts as we move forward.
I urge you to check out the Storytelling and Organizing Project so that you can contribute to their growing toolkit of community-based solutions for dealing with violence, and so that you can add to the tools you already have within you to deal with situations of harm in your life. And don't forget, you are powerful, and we are limitless.